Welcome to the Shaping Portsmouth podcast. Shaping Portsmouth is a collaboration of key Portsmouth businesses, transforming Portsmouth together. Hello and welcome to another Shaping Portsmouth podcast with me, CEO Dave Humphreys. And today I'm joined by Sally Spicer from Talent Included. Welcome, Sally.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited about this.
No, you're very welcome. It's great to have you here. So, you run your own business, Talent Included, along with Natalie Clark.
Absolutely.
We'll talk a bit more about the business itself as we go on. But let's find out a bit about you. Do you come from Portsmouth originally?
Portsmouth, born and bred. I'm a St. Mary's girl. So yeah, absolutely. I've lived here my whole life.
Excellent. So your business based in the city, but also across the wider area. I think Natalie's Southampton based. Mm-hmm. So you're covering more of a sort of wider area between you. So Talent Included is recruitment and EDI specialist.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We've got three kind of distinct parts of the business. So Natalie and I are recruiters by trade. I've been a recruiter for over 25 years and moved actually into the EDI space. And I'll tell you that story a little bit later on. So we've got an EDI, so we formed Talent Included, which has got an EDI consultancy arm to the business. So we help businesses on their inclusion journeys.
Yeah.
But we also work with individuals from a career coaching perspective. With our background in recruitment and navigating through, you know, choppy recruitment markets, employment markets, and helping individuals really kind of find purposeful work, we work with individuals on a one-to-one to help kind of realise that, really.
So, we'll come back to that in a second, but what led you into that in the first place then? How did you end up?
Yeah, I mean, and this is the story, and this is kind of how it all kind of knits together. So I was working as a recruiter. I was in the finance and accountancy space, so I recruited accountants.
Right.
And my clients came to me and said, we need a gender balance shortlist. I was recruiting at a senior level, and so there was a pressure at that time for organisations to really readdress gender balance within their organisations. And it was something that never really ever occurred to me before. I think as a female, as I was working, I'd never really kind of seen that inequality. You know, I'd always, you know, luckily done pretty well. So I wasn't, you know, kind of facing kind of discrimination myself. But it's only when I then really started to lean in and listen to the female candidates I was representing, I started to see where the inequalities were essentially and where inequity in processes, recruitment processes, kind of was rife. So I really started kind of leaning into those females and trying to figure out what it was that was holding them back. Lots of them had reached their kind of, you know, the dizzy heights of their career and had children. And they thought, actually, I don't want to leave this current company because I've got part-time working. I've got my flexible working, you know, arrangement. I don't want to rock the apple cart. I don't want to have to go and try and, you know, prove myself another organisation. And part-time roles at those kind of senior levels were pretty scarce at the time. But also I was really leaning into ladies who were coming to me and saying things like, you know, I'm really unhappy in my job. I'm happy to go for another one, but I don't really want to be paid any more money. You know, there was this kind of real kind of lack mindset around. And it's only when I really started kind of tapping into that and listening, I thought, my goodness, I've got to do something about this. So in my spare time, I set up a side hustle, my first kind of realm into, you know, entrepreneurship. And I retrained as a coach. So I was still recruiting, but I retrained as a coach and was coaching females to advance their careers, essentially. And I went through kind of neuro-linguistic programming training and set up a business and was just about to kind of go all in on that business. I was completely transparent with the company I was working for. During that time, I set up our first kind of female, what are now known as kind of employee resource groups within the organisation, so kind of an internal network, and created a female leadership programme. And set up our first DEI council or EDI council within the organisation and was just about to go all in on that when they said, look, don't leave, come and be our head of EDI. So that was really when I started moving away just from gender work into kind of all the, you know, discrimination and disparities that we've seen in equities we see in the workplace. So that's what took me into the world of EDI.
So what got you into recruitment in the first place? How did you end up there?
How did I end up in recruitment? Do you know what? I was going to be a midwife.
Right. They couldn't be further apart, could they, really?
I was going to be a midwife and went to uni and just really didn't enjoy it. And I then kind of went home after a semester. I mean, I probably didn't give it a long enough shot. And said to my mum, look, mum, I'm not enjoying this at all. I was working in a pub at the time. And one of our locals came in and said, we're looking for an administrator. Come and work for us. So I said, brilliant, I will do. So did that as a spares administrator for a air conditioning company. Absolutely loved it. Only to be, 18 months, 2 years later, made redundant. So I worked at the Office of National Statistics that summer. It was it was the census year. So I was responsible. This is back in the day when you had to type in. So all the census papers would come in the post. And I was sat there for a whole summer inputting them into a system. And it was coming to an end. And I thought, my goodness, I better apply for some jobs. And one of them just happened to be a recruitment consultant job for a company called Personnel Selection, who were based in Commercial Road. Applied for loads of jobs, went for loads of interviews. Got offered a job at the dockyard and thought, you know what, I'm just going to go for this interview later in the week. And I walked in and I thought, this is the job for me. And I was the first person they interviewed that day. They saw 10 people and they offered me the job. And I genuinely haven't looked back. I absolutely loved it from day one. I still do. I still really, really enjoy recruiting. And that career kind of took, I've been doing it for over 25 years.
So what is it about recruiting that you really enjoy? Gives you the satisfaction.
It's really interesting because when I went on that first interview on that first day, they said, why do you want the job? And I said, you know what? I just really want to help people. I really want to help people. Now that, to any recruitment firm, if anyone ever said that, they would already be kind of halfway out the door. That's not what we're about. Yeah. We're a sales business. But that has stayed true to my core from that day. I just like making a difference. I love making a difference in people's careers. Because I've been doing it for so long, I've placed some people 2, 3, 4 times over and seen their career grow. But also from a client perspective, it's about really interpreting what it is that they want and what it is that they need and helping kind of create that opportunity. So, yeah, I've always loved it and I always will. I kind of, whenever I recruited a role last week for an MD for a growing company. It just gives me a really, amazing sense of, achievement, really.
Yeah, definitely. So we'll come back to the DEI side of it or EDI, whichever way around you want to do it. Let's talk about Talent Included then. That's your business with Natalie. Yep. How did that come about?
That came about from me really missing the people interaction when I was in my so I didn't leave the company I was working for. I then went into their global head of EDI. It was a brand new role, brand new form role, helped them set up their strategy and their ESG strategy as well, which is the environmental, social and governance. So that's kind of all around sustainability. And loved it, learned a lot there and helped a lot of our clients kind of on their EDI journeys as well. But I really missed the people interaction. I really missed connecting and helping individuals. And so Natalie and I worked with each other for one of their brands, the company I work for 15 years. And we said, it's time for us to go out and do this on our own. It's time. Natalie has always recruited in the HR space. So she was kind of, seen firsthand from an HR perspective, this kind of, the forming of EDI roles within the UK. And there was a real need for organisations to understand what these roles were in order to be able to recruit them properly. It's a really nuanced world, and I'm sure we'll talk about this later on, but it's a really nuanced space. And so we had this kind of deep understanding because of the journey that we've been on, both individually as recruiters, but also helping the organisation that we're working for on their inclusion journey. And we thought, actually, there's a real calling for this out there. Businesses need support in this area. So we thought, we've got a huge network, not only in the South Coast, we do a lot of work with London clients as well, to really be able to share best practice and help them on those inclusion journeys, whether it is through specific programmes around inclusive recruitment or whether it's about building that strategy and understanding what it means to them as an organisation and how they can progress, really.
It's interesting that that kind of sort of nuanced specialism side of it. Within Shaping, we've maybe 5 recruitment businesses as partners.
but everyone specialises in something different. Mm. Do you think there's a, I suppose not an advantage, but an importance to be able to specialise in particular things?
Absolutely. I think you need to know your industry inside and out to know what good looks like. Mm. You need to be able to have seen people go through that career journey themselves to see how it evolves. And it's interesting because I held a session up in London a couple of weeks ago about the evolution of EDI. And I really looked back on, I mean, when I worked in my finance and accountancy world, how roles evolved during that time. You know, over that 20-year plus experience, you saw roles go from being non-existent to being business critical. Yeah. And that's where I see the world of EDI going. You know, we're in probably the second or third cycle of what EDI looks like within organisations. And I'm sure we're going to talk about the political backlash at some point during our discussion today. But it's really important how businesses continue to evolve, not just from a financial perspective, but from how we encourage, you know, how we attract people, how we talent manage, how we make sure that our businesses are resilient. And EDI inclusion and the people agenda needs to be front and centre of that, especially with the adoption of AI and automation. It's a really pressing need to be able to differentiate yourself. And culture within organisations is going to be one of the key differentiators in this kind of transformation that we're going to be seeing over the next couple of years.
I suppose before delving into that kind of evolution piece, it's probably just good to clarify for anyone that's listening that is thinking to themselves, what are they talking about here with EDI, DEI, what on earth does it stand for? Mm. So we're talking about equality, diversity and inclusion.
We were talking about equality, diversity, and it's very much changed to equity now. And equity is about creating an opportunity to level the playing field.
Yeah.
It's recognising that there are inequalities in workplaces, in society at large, and equity is embedding the foundations to ensure that everyone has a fair shot.
Yeah. I always remember, harking back to my policing days, when we started doing a lot in this sort of area ourselves, there was a little phrase that used to get bandied around, which was equity is getting an invite to the dance. Diversity is being allowed in. Inclusion is someone asking you to dance.
Something along those lines. Yeah. Something along those lines.
And I always kind of quite like that. I suppose there is an obvious issue around equality versus equity in that, that, you know, if you treat everyone equally, then outcome is not going to be equal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because everyone's different.
Mm.
The whole piece is very complicated because, you know, diversity means nothing if inclusion's not there.
Absolutely.
So from a business perspective, it's quite a difficult area to navigate.
Mm.
How you mentioned the evolution of EDI. Mm. What does that look like? How has EDI evolved?
It's evolved through lots of kind of macro forces. If we think about the kind of geopolitics that we're seeing at the moment, we're seeing that EDI is being used as a political football.
Yeah.
And so it is having to evolve because I think what a lot of organisations did is say, oh, we need more diversity. We need more of this type of individual, okay, which creates polarisation. Mm. It creates a feeling of being othered to those in the majority. And so this whole kind of narrative has been created that if we're actually creating opportunities for those who belong in marginalised groups, those in the majority groups are the ones who are going to suffer. And that has then been picked up by the media and that has been picked up by political parties to use to sway people in terms of their support. And the impact that has had on the industry, on the profession, has been catastrophic. So what we're seeing now in terms of EDI is this evolution of like, what does it actually mean? What is it that we're actually trying to create. Yep. Because there's been so many different publications by like the Harvard Business Review, by, you know, big, you know, consultant, you know, the big four consulting firms that demonstrate that if we have more diverse and more inclusive working practices, we have a better performing business because it directly correlates to businesses being more resilient, businesses being more innovative, creating that feeling of psychological safety within teams, you know, ensures that everyone's got, you know, who has an opinion is able to share those views and they're listened to. So businesses become more resilient by embedding inclusion. So what a lot of businesses did was say, right, let's start off by hiring lots of different types of people and saying that, you know, our doors are open to everyone, which is great. But that what then that did is create othering, and it created a barrier and polarization. But what businesses didn't do is ensure that the systems and processes that they had within those organizations ensured that those individuals would be able to thrive. And when I say thrive, I mean contribute. And I also mean, you know, be, you know, get promoted and really be in positions of what we would call power.
Yeah.
And so that is where lots of EDI initiatives and, you know, programs face a lot of scrutiny, because what we recommend organizations do is actually let's start with just creating equity. Okay, let's not overcomplicate it. Let's look at the processes and the systems that are the foundation and the bedrock of our organization. Let's ensure they are set and set up to ensure that anyone, regardless who comes to the business, is able to kind of thrive and to contribute. And then if we create a place of, you know, psychological safety, of belonging, of inclusion, the diversity bit comes as a byproduct of all of that. And also the business performance comes as a byproduct of that. So we kind of have to turn it on its head for it to, you know, to enable it to actually have an impact, essentially. And what businesses want is to be able to attract the best possible people in order to ensure that their business is resilient and create environments where they haven't got lots of ER cases. They haven't got cases of discrimination in the office. They haven't got cases where individuals don't feel safe coming to work. And by doing that, you're creating a place where psychological safety thrives and organisations can benefit off the back of that.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. The the whole piece around diversity and innovation, I think, is really quite important. That diversity of thought and having that mix of different opinions and stuff in your business. And again, you know, that experience I had in policing when there was a really big agenda that our recruitment needs to reflect the population we police. So we've got to now recruit X amount of different types of people so that we reflect society more widely. But if you haven't got the inclusion piece right, you just end up, it's almost like the Star Trek analogy, I suppose, the Borg, you assimilate people, you know, you're now in, now you need to change the way you think to be like us, rather than us saying, you're now in, what's your perspective on this? Because we value your opinion. And that seems to be the sort of the much more difficult piece in that, you know, you can recruit a particular type of characteristic quite easily, but actually valuing the difference and making the most of it once you've got those people in your organisation is what gets you the real benefit.
I think you made two really good points there. So firstly, if you think about the communities that you serve, okay, and your staff being reflected of those, but also the consumers that you're trying to sell to, okay? And I came off the back of an event a couple of weeks ago, which was Grocery Aid, Diversity in Grocery Aid. And that's a huge charity that works across the whole grocery industry that understands the benefit of having diverse thought. So we talk about, and I'll talk about groupthink in a minute, but all of their product development is based on their consumers, okay? There was the most incredible keynote by someone called Lucy Edwards, who I would implore everyone to go and have a look at online. And she... She's a lady who's blind, who helps big businesses big consumer brand businesses to innovate products for the blind community. And the work she does is absolutely incredible. And there are huge businesses, like businesses like Unilever, who are going out and consulting with people like Lucy Edwards to say, how do I make my product more accessible? Because they understand the benefit of giving their products accessibility to those who are blind, for example. So it's really interesting. And what I find fascinating about this work is, depending on what industry that you're working in, enables you to see and kind of turn up the dial in terms of what the importance they put on kind of EDI work. But if we also see it from like a customer perspective around banking, they see it as a huge risk. It's on their risk register in terms of, you know, if your workforce, it doesn't represent the customers that you're serving, how can you meet their needs? So, you know, any kind of service-based business are really kind of drilling down on how can we make our products more and services more accessible? How can we make them more inclusive? You think about all the different languages, you know, individuals speak within this, within the country. It's incredible. So even having those on the team who understand the nuances of being able to translate and communicate in different languages is really important. But we met recently and you talked about a book called Rebel Ideas that you'd read, which is just fascinating. And it's about, it gives you these real life examples of what happens when groupthink exists. And one of those being the 9/11 attack. And so there was you might want to tell the story in terms of,
It's a brilliant book, one of my favourites, by a guy called Matthew Syed.
Yeah.
And the reality of the 9/11 terror attacks was that the CIA had plenty of warning in advance that this was likely to happen and just dismissed it as a completely impossible idea.
Mm.
And they were watching the videos from Osama bin Laden, essentially, in a cave somewhere in the sort of desert in Pakistan or wherever, putting out these sort of very political broadcasts about what he was going to do and what he wanted people to do. And they just completely dismissed it out of hand as being possible, because there was no way this sort of person living remotely in a cave on a mountainside in Pakistan or wherever it was could possibly orchestrate that attack. And when they came down to, I suppose, the hard lessons that you learn afterwards and you start unpicking what's happened and why it's happened, they identified that there was no diversity in the CIA at all. They had nobody from a background, either religious, from the Muslim aspect, that could explain to them some of the nuances of Islam, etc. But they also had no one from those backgrounds that could interpret the messaging and why it was being carried out in that way and what it really meant.
Mm.
So they completely missed the opportunity to prevent quite a horrendous terror attack.
Absolutely. And I think this is it. So when we talk about the evolution of EDI, it's moving away from this kind of performative action, and which is what everyone's seeing in terms of what we call it, a kind of flags and festivals.
Yeah.
You know, that cultural awareness piece and sharing of lived experiences is really important. But what we've lost sight of through this kind of media and kind of political kind of landslide is that actually it's good for business.
Yeah.
And businesses who are demonstrating commitment to EDI are outperforming their peers.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. There's another great story in that book. Well, it's not great, actually. It's pretty horrific. And I remember this, again, linked to policing. Mm. I remember this happening at the time, which was the introduction of DNA evidence when that first came in. And there's a story in the book about a police department somewhere in America and a conviction for it was either a rape or a murder. And the DNA evidence arrived eventually that proved that the guy that they locked up was innocent.
Mm.
And they couldn't accept it. Mm. They wouldn't accept it.
Yeah.
And it was that whole, you know, it was almost the groupthink of the whole town.
Mm.
It created such a problem in the narrative that they'd all sort of subscribed to and believed that this was no longer solved, that they couldn't actually come to release the guy even though they knew he was innocent.
Yeah.
They were trying to defend the position.
Mm.
Very It's a book well worth a read.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, he's got he's got a couple of books, but yeah, he's absolutely brilliant. But it is, it's around actually, let's just take the noise around or away from actually what we're trying to discuss and think about how can we build resilient businesses, okay, that are going to be able to adapt and be agile. That's the key skill that we're going to need as an organisation. Mm. Someone who's going to be able to come in and go, I don't think we should be doing this. I think we should be doing something else. There's something else that's coming down, you know, down the road that we need to be aware of. And how are we going to build our, you know, our teams to be able to, you know, have that cognitive diversity that is going to take us through these kind of turbulent times. I think there's, you know, the only common thread that we've all, you know, the golden thread that we've got is that change is upon us. Change is our only constant, you know, doing business in this really kind of VUCA environment at the moment is the only thing that we can be sure of. So how are we going to protect ourselves and ensure that we are, you know, going to evolve and be resilient in the business, essentially?
Definitely. So let's step into that political space that you alluded to earlier then.
Yes.
And, you know, as there's a lot of pushback coming from certain quarters.
Yes.
On DEI.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take on that?
It wins votes. It helps. It helps to other. It helps to polarise and exactly what politics is about. And so it's used something that makes the majority feel like, yeah, do you know what? It's not us, okay? It really validates those feelings. And it's been used to essentially dismantle decades of work that's been put into the equity space. Mm. Yeah, it's quite scary. It's quite scary.
It is. And I think when you add in the whole concept of the social media echo chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And people believing stuff that's being fed back to them, which is absolute nonsense. And in fact, so I don't know when this recording will go out, but yesterday I was reading something about a particular Reform Member of Parliament commenting on the percentage of non-white people that appeared in television adverts. So I don't know whether you've seen this, but over the weekend it's caused a little bit of outrage, and over 50% of television adverts contain someone who is non-white, and that's disproportionate. We're now pandering to the non-white population, apparently. But what happened on social media, depending on what you looked at, but you started seeing these feeds that started pushing that the non-white population of the UK is only 4% compared to 50% of adverts containing someone that's non-white. Now, that's rubbish for a start. It's nearer 18%.
Mm.
But you've got all of these people supporting their own narrative with this misinformation that is then being pushed further and further and further on social media.
Mm.
Really quite outrageous. And then, of course, you add in the fact that 50% of adverts might contain a non-white person, but they're not necessarily the star of the advert. You know, your lead character is not necessarily that.
Mm.
And if you watch adverts, like just for one advertisement break, it's absolute rubbish.
Mm.
It does broadly reflect the actual makeup of the population. So it's someone just playing on stats to create a narrative, to assert their own need, which is, as you say, polarizing. Mm. And that's the problem. But there's clearly a real agenda around this coming from the US.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen, you know, some of the things that have been called out over there. And I think they put a helicopter crash down to...
A disability,
you know, too much diversity. It's just nonsense.
Mm.
How do you think that is affecting things here?
I think it's kickstarting this evolution, which I don't think was a bad thing. I think even those in the DEI space have enabled the work to become politicised as opposed to focusing on the work. It seems that there was a real kind of, you're right, you're wrong narrative. Mm. This is how you should be thinking. This is how you should be leading teams. And I think people got fed up of being told what to do rather than actually, I mean, we liken it to, you know, we created one inclusion door and expected everyone to walk through it, yep, rather than actually, you know, if you've got a team of 200, creating 200 different inclusion doors, what does it mean to you? How can, you know, what impact can you have and do you want to have, rather than telling everyone they were wrong all the time? So I think this is where some of the evolution is coming. And also not playing into that kind of the political stance, which I know is really important because, difficult for some people to kind of get their head around because it has been so kind of intrinsically linked. But we need to be more objective and we actually need to approach the work from a place of neutrality more than you're right, you're wrong, because what the you're right, you're wrong is enabled organizations to completely, you know, feel paralyzed, not know what to do, not know what they're standing for, not know what, you know, how to communicate. And also, if you think about the events that have happened over the last couple of years, you know, the killing, the brutal killing of George Floyd, the two wars that we've got, you know, well, two very major wars that we've got on every moment, that businesses were feeling under pressure to make a stand and make a stance. But because they're so more commonplace now, it's like, well, where do we stop? Do we need to be talking about this as well? Do we need to be talking about that? Actually, rather than centering on what inclusion means to them and their organization and actually what their values are, you know, how do we live the values that the businesses hold so, you know, at such an important part of their culture? How do we center back on that? How do we navigate through people within our workforces having very different belief systems and different beliefs? How do we mitigate that as a risk? And within the organ, how do we keep our people safe? And when we've spoken a lot over the last couple of weeks, but I think what we have failed to realize and remember is this is humanity, okay? And this is about safety and about people feeling and being safe, because what's happening outside our, you know, workplaces, I can assure you, is happening inside them, and safety needs to be front and center.
Yeah. So I think before I step into the what could we possibly do about this, I think because of some of the things that you said there, I'll ask, why is that important to businesses in Portsmouth? Why is inclusion important to local business?
Because we live in this incredible multicultural city, you know. It has got so much richness in terms of all the people that inhabit this city, all the amazing people that inhabit this city. And we need to keep them safe. You know, we need to create workplaces that are create equity so everyone can have an opportunity to work there. And we can help them develop and help them thrive. Everyone thrive, not just those from marginalised groups. Everyone. It's really important to us as a city to, from an economical perspective, to continue, you know, getting investment and for our businesses to continue thriving. And this is going to be the differentiator.
Absolutely. I think feelings of safety, it's a bit like fairness. It doesn't actually matter whether something's essentially fair or not. If you perceive it to be unfair, it's a problem. And perceptions of safety are exactly the same. If people don't feel safe, it doesn't matter whether, you know, you can throw all the stats at someone you like that show that, you know, you are fundamentally safe. But if you don't feel safe, it is a problem. And it makes it very, very difficult. So as a business community, in a city like Portsmouth, where we do have strong communities and we do have a strong community as a business community, what can we do? What could we do to address this?
I think we need to come together. Step one, come together and really define what inclusion means to us as a city. Okay. How do we want to operate? What's it going to feel like, you know, from a cultural perspective? And I'm not talking, you know, I'm talking about how it actually feels to live and work in this city. And define, you know, what our standards are. What are our standards? What does good look like? And how can we then ensure that our businesses kind of take the lead and take the stance on that?
Okay. So one of the things we've spoken about is an inclusion charter.
It is.
So what would that look like?
It would look like that, us coming together as a city and ensuring that we are standards that we're holding ourselves to account for, okay? And these standards are going to be embedded within our organisations from an equity perspective, from, you know, giving confidence and sharing education around what good looks like in this space. It's not about just kind of signing a piece of paper saying, yep, I've signed up for that, and then we're just going to kind of leave it, you know, in a frame on the wall. It's like, what does inclusion look like in practice? And depending on the size of the organisation, depending on the sector it sits in, you know, there's so many nuances in this space. We need to create a benchmark to say this is what good looks like for this type of organisation, and this is what good looks like. Because I think because within the EDI space, if we talk about the D, if we talk about diversity, and we talk about the 9 protected characteristics, and that isn't even including kind of social mobility, there's an awful lot. It can feel quite overwhelming. I should be doing something for this particular protected characteristic. I should be doing for something this. I should be doing for something like this. And all of those things are important. But from a resource perspective and from a budget perspective, that's actually not possible. And what we tend to see, and where we've seen a lot of scrutiny in the EDI work, is that there's lots of kind of work around representation. Mm. There's lots of work around kind of celebrating different holidays. There's lots of work around, you know, being involved with Pride. All of those things are really, really important. But if actually you're a business under 100 people, how do you do that? How is that even possible? So it's around actually relating it back to values, how we want to, why inclusion is important to us. Is it because of the products that we sell? Is it because of all the services that we sell, or, you know, our offering out there into the market? And how can we make EDI run as a kind of golden thread through all of that, really? And how can we come together? So the charter is not just going to be around kind of standards, and it's not just going to be around compliance, but how do we come together as a community to share best practice and to collaborate more, to say, actually, there's 5 businesses here who all want to do something around Pride. There's 5 businesses here who all want to do something around inclusive hiring because they understand that their hiring practices maybe aren't as equitable as they could be. Let's come together to work through that rather than everyone kind of duplicating work and not having the capacity or the budget to do it.
Yeah. And I think some of that was probably going to answer my next question, which was, you know, the charter's great, but how do you then turn that into tangible actions that help businesses actually achieve that embedding equity piece?
Absolutely.
And that's a lot of it, isn't it? That coming together, the sharing of best practice, mm-hmm. the looking at common agendas, working together.
It's knowing that you're not in it on your own, really. Because I think so many businesses have got such good intent with this work because they realise the benefits in terms of business performance, and they're like, I want a piece of that. But it's actually, how do we make it nuanced for those organisations? So we run audits, and we're going to be running some free workshops in terms of like taking these topics and bringing them to life, showing what good kind of, you know, good practice is. But that audit is around like where you are, you know, and how do we make it relevant to you? And this can be like in all sorts of forms. We're doing work with organisations at the moment around actually giving them an employee voice. So ensuring that they're actually providing opportunities to listen to how their workforce actually feel. And then using the sentiment, both from qualitative and quantitative data from those employee surveys, to say, okay, this is what inclusion looks like in our organisation, and these are the things that we need to work on. So it could be leadership capability. It could be, actually, we've got these 4 values on the wall, but they're not actually embedded in anything. You know, they're just, you know, they're just letters on a wall. They don't actually mean anything. So it's, how do we make it relevant for those individual organisations, and how can we essentially take them on a journey so that the efforts that they're doing aren't performative, they have real links to business performance. And we do that essentially through a whole talent life cycle. So if you think about an employee life cycle from attraction right the way through to someone leaving, and all the touch points you'd have around engagement, promotion, development, and then kind of, you know, engagement and offboarding, ensuring that you've got equity as a golden thread through all of that different life cycles will ensure that the business, you know, realises benefit in terms of business performance.
Brilliant. And what is the outcome of that then? What is the vision? How will we know when we've landed this?
Better performing businesses, more engaged staff, less attrition, you know, more diversity and representation, I think, is the most important thing in senior roles within the organisation. Ensuring that people have got access to work. Those would be the kind of key. And, it, you know, we talk a lot in this space around it being kind of cathedral thinking. You know, yeah. We're doing the work now and laying the foundations for benefits that we might not even see in our lifetime. But, you know, if you're thinking about culture and the talent that's going to be coming into your workforce over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, being the biggest differentiators your business is going to have, it has to be front and centre.
Yeah, I like absolutely. That phrase. I've not heard that one before, cathedral thinking. I like that.
I know, but yeah.
One of my biggest frustrations, especially coming out of the public sector, is five-year election cycle-based strategies when most problems need a generational one to solve them.
They do.
And I like that. But yeah, it's ultimately good for business. It's good for economic growth. It's good for our city.
Yeah.
It's got to be the right thing to do.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, to the point where what we're seeing on our streets at the moment, you know, if we can't be naive to think that that isn't happening within our organisations. Mm. And so, you know, we've got to protect the city, essentially. And I think this is the way to do it.
Excellent. Look, we could talk for hours on equity, diversity and inclusion. There's loads to cover there. And I have no doubt it will be conversations that we pick up in other forums. But let's come back to Portsmouth.
Yes.
Let's come back to Portsmouth. And we always like to finish up our podcast by asking our guest to make a recommendation of somewhere they like to go or something they like to do in Portsmouth. So obviously being Portsmouth born and bred, you're going to have no end of recommendations, but what would be your top tip, Sally?
My number one, this is a shameless plug now. So my lovely husband and his mum have run a restaurant in Southsea for over 25 years. It's called Sopranos.
Right.
They're not Italian, but their food is, yeah. And it's absolutely incredible. So it's a local business. It's in Southsea. I eat there a lot, as you can imagine, but it's amazing. And what they have achieved over that 25 years is absolutely amazing. They've got a really strong community-focused business. So I would recommend anyone go and check out some pasta or some pizza at Sopranos on Palmerston Road.
Excellent. That's I think it's cropped up as a recommendation previously as well.
I don't think
this is the first time we've had it on the podcast, actually.
Oh,
I think it has. But food tends to be quite a theme on these podcasts. So you mentioned your husband and his mum. So yeah. Was it a family business? Was it mum started it?
And then he went in, 25 years. Well, she's still working.
Wow.
I know. She's still working. She's like the matriarch. She's incredible. But yeah, they've had it for 25 years, which is just incredible.
Nice.
Yeah, I know.
And I can imagine you do probably eat there a lot. So yeah. And why wouldn't you? Brilliant. Great recommendation. Always love a good food one. So yeah, we'll be sure to go and check that one out. It's been great chatting to you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I'm really excited to see where this is going to go. So yeah, I really appreciate the airtime.
Definitely. And for any Portsmouth businesses listening, just watch out for the charter and the work that we're going to try and drive around this, workshops and support that will be available.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I look forward to seeing you all there.
Brilliant. Thanks, Sally.
Thanks, Dave.
This podcast was brought to you by Shaping Portsmouth, working to make Portsmouth the number one UK city in which to invest, live, learn, work and visit. To find out more, please visit shapingportsmouth.co.uk. This podcast was supported by Spark Community Space and Portsmouth Community Lottery.